This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. On today's show, racial tension in the U.S. is rising, and President Obama says he wants to make this a top priority during the remaining months of his presidency. Now, a new report shows one way that he plans to do that. The headline in the New York Post is, "Obama collecting personal data for a secret racial database." Now, this raises some really concerning questions about the government harvesting this kind of data, but even more concerning is what are they going to do with it? Trumpet writer Robert Morley has written an article about these policies that this administration is planning to enact. We're going to talk with him to explain this to us, and we'll see what some of the outcomes of the solutions that this administration is proposing might be. The Iranian nuclear deal has raised the specter of Iran becoming a nuclear state. Now, a nuclear war is something that is very unreal to most of us. It's been a long time since anyone suffered the effects of a nuclear bomb. Trumpet writer Brad McDonald has written an article discussing the reality of nuclear war by looking at those who have experienced it, the people who went through the attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II. This is a really important segment that I think will just help you to make this subject, which is very important, just more real in your mind and in your imagination. Last week marked the successful completion of a 9.5-year mission to have a probe fly by what was once known as the ninth and last planet in our solar system, Pluto. They did it. They achieved it. It was an amazing scientific achievement. We're going to get into some of the details about that and celebrate that accomplishment. And we're going to talk about why that really should be inspiring to all of us. I'll finish off today's show by talking about just how unique it is that this gem of a planet we live on can support us. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Racial tension in the United States is rising, and President Obama has said he wants to do something about it. Now, recently, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, wrote a powerful article, gave a television program about how to solve America's race problems. Really beautiful program, and I want to encourage you to find that on thetrumpet.com or find it on YouTube. It's a really important program, a really important article. But here, we have another very different approach to solving America's race problems, and I'm sure one that's going to have very different results. The president's administration is focusing more and more attention on what is called institutionalized racism, those areas where differences in experience among the races can only be viewed as springing from inherent racism within the system. The president has said racism is in our DNA as a nation, and now he's looking to address that problem through policies that will supposedly correct it. Trumpet writer Robert Morley has written an article about these policies and about what the administration is planning to do. I have him here with me in the studio to explain this to us, and we're going to talk about what the outcomes of these supposed solutions might be. Robert, what is going on here?
Well, President Obama has launched what some people are calling an unprecedented collection of sensitive data on Americans. The New York Post called it the largest consolidation of personal data in U.S. history. So the government, President Obama, is using harnessing the power of the federal agencies to build a database of personal information to what people are saying is an effort to ferret out racial and economic injustice. So we're seeing the creation of a database that is much bigger, much more encompassing than anything the NSA has done to this point. The NSA got a lot of flack for spying on millions of Americans. Well, here's a database that's being constructed and already being used that will collect the very personal, intimate details of Americans, all Americans, and categorize it and be searchable based on the race of Americans.
How are they getting this information? And what, say, would the racial information that you're talking about be linked to? What other pieces of information and what sort of wisdom would they supposedly be able to ferret out from that?
the most personal information you can practically think of. Everything from your mortgage, your personal finances, your credit rating, to your health records, to where you live, what zip code you're in, what neighborhood you live in, your street address, right down to whether or not your children are getting disciplined at school. Have they ever been suspended? Have they ever had an expulsion from school? How much debt you have? Where do you work? Have you ever been incarcerated? Do you have arrest records? This is the data that's being collected and being combined into a centralized database that also links it to your race. And that's the effort of this program. It's to be able to look and find differences between Americans based on race.
First of all, where is this information coming from? How do we know this is happening?
Right. So the government collects this data through several different agencies. Over the last 8 years, several new agencies have come into existence at the federal level. We have the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That's one of these financial agencies that collects data on people, everything from their credit rating to their credit card usage to usage with banks. There's also the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that came into existence to supposedly protect consumers against being exploited by banks, but they collect vast amounts of data on who are using the banking system and who banks give loans to, things like that. There's a Civil Rights Data Collection Project, which targets the education system. And it collects data on everything from discipline rates to student performance and grading to how much money is being spent per student in schools and school facilities. There's the civil rights. There's the Justice Department, which is monitoring federal prisons. So and there's even probably the most Orwellian of these new government surveillance programs is what's called the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Database. And this is one of the newest agencies. And what it's doing is it's charting neighborhoods by racial groupings. And the purpose of it is to identify neighborhoods that need rebalancing. If a neighborhood is not sufficiently deemed integrated enough, well, then the purpose of this is to identify those neighborhoods so that that can be a change, can be affected.
And you're saying that they're actually doing this according to racial profiles or are there other factors?
Right. That's the whole purpose of what's happening here. President Obama has said that he wants to make race relations the centerpiece of his remaining time in office. Recently, in an interview that he gave on the Mark Marone Show, he said that racism in America affects almost every institution in the country. And this is his attempt to identify where racism exists, find examples of it so that he can make the changes.
So they look at bank information and they say, you're not giving enough mortgage loans to blacks as opposed to whites.
Right. So at a simplest, that's what it comes down to. Recently, there was a lawsuit that was that went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled on what's called disparate impact. And that's this concept that underlies what the president administration is trying to do here with this racial database. It's this idea that within America, you have certain percentages of races. And when things happen that disproportionately affect one race, that is evidence of racism within the system, the evidence of the institutionalized racism. And when that happens, the Supreme Court has ruled now, then efforts can be taken, lawsuits can be allowed to fix that, to stop that where that happens. So, for example, as you brought out with the banks, so far the Justice Department has gone after several of the large Wall Street banks over what they call disparate impact in lending. So where these big banks have not given enough loans to minority communities. So the black community in America is approximately 13%. And what they're finding is that these banks have not given 13% of their prime loans, your highest, best quality loan to black people in America. And they say this is evidence of racism. Now, you have to remember that disparate impact does not consider mitigating factors. All it says is that a certain minority group is being impacted beyond what you would expect based on the percentage of the population. And if that happens, then you're guilty. Under civil rights laws, you're having a disparate impact on a certain racial group, and you're liable for that. And the Justice Department has collected hundreds of millions of dollars in penalties,
right,
in fines. well, $200 million from Bank of America.
And Bank of America's crime was disparate impact. They were not giving 13% of their best loans to black people.
That's right. And Bank of America says, well, look, this isn't, they argue, this isn't on purpose. There's certain lending standards we need to go by. This is how we do business. If you qualify for a prime loan, we'll give one to you. There's been studies that have been conducted that black people in general have lower credit on average than, say, white people do or Asians do in America.
So
that explains it, but that doesn't matter.
So in this particular case, they can't say, well, now, wait a minute, let's just cut the list according to what the credit scores were with the people who received the loans of the proper credit rating. That essentially every factor is excluded from the mix other than just race.
That's right. That's what's happening here. Bank of America has tried to defend itself using what most people would consider logic and just like practical, you know, this is why. There's a very good reason why this is happening, but okay, that doesn't matter. The government says you have to remedy that somehow because you're disproportionately affecting a certain race.
Well, is the government's argument that the reason why, say, African-Americans would have lower credit scores would reflect racism on the institutional level? I mean, is that essentially I guess it's difficult to link that with anything in particular that Bank of America did. But I guess, is that the underlying argument here?
Well, yeah. The government's arguing that in any situation in which there's different outcomes based from what you'd expect based on percentages of people in certain races, that's an example of racism, and that needs to be combated. It doesn't matter what reality dictates. So let me give you another example. You can look at what's happening in the school system. The federal government is now collecting data on every school district in the United States, expulsion rates, suspension rates, disciplinary actions, grades, everything. It's all going into federal government database. And they've already taken action against certain schools, which they found that suspend black students at rates that exceed the white students that get suspended. So in Minneapolis schools and St. Paul schools, they found that black students were being expelled at rates higher than whites. And they said, this is evidence of racism. You need to change that. If you don't change that, we will prosecute you. And the school districts, they don't have money to defend themselves. The teachers in these districts say, look, we're just suspending kids because they have behavioral issues and they're making problems in the classrooms. What do you want us to do? Keep them in the classrooms? Well, the Justice Department says, look, this is what the number is saying. Black students are getting expelled at far greater rates than you would suspect in the population. So this is an example of disparate impact. So what did the school districts do? They said, okay, well, we're going to comply with the Justice Department. We are just going to stop expelling and suspending black students. We're only going to expel and suspend white and Asians now. So blacks and Latinos get a free pass in Minneapolis and St. Paul until the rates come back down into equilibrium based on the percent of population.
You've got 1,000 students. You've got 500 black students, 500 white students. If 10 students get suspended, you'd better have 5 black students and 5 white students among those 10, or else that proves that you're a racist institution.
Well, that's right. And unfortunately, now what's being implemented is reverse racism.
How could it not? I'm just thinking... Right. I'm thinking, I have 3 children. If I discipline my son more than my 2 daughters, that this is somehow evidence of my inherent sexism. It couldn't have anything to do with the fact that he acts up more than they. That's essentially the problem here.
Right. And that's what a lot of people have argued is, look, the black community, it's well known. They suffer from much higher rates of broken families, much higher rates of alcoholism and drug abuse. And these are the factors that are playing into these behavioral issues. I mean, if children don't have, they're living in single parent homes or they're living with their grandma with many other children under one roof, it's just natural that they're going to have behavioral issues that children who come from the white racial group that isn't affected to such a large degree, you're going to have differences. And that's what explains these things.
In other words, if you exclude race from the mix and you factor in things like family integrity, then the differences go away.
Exactly. And there's been studies that show that, that have shown that when you account for some of those disparities, everything from income inequality to incarceration in jails to criminal activity, that disappears.
So what the president is saying recently is that the reason for the family breakdown is inherent racism. that it's racism in the system that's causing the family breakdown.
Oh, that's definitely his argument. He said back in June that America has been racist for 200-300 years. That doesn't change overnight, and that's what's contributing to a lot of these problems. And he linked it to the criminal justice system, and he said the criminal justice system is inherently racist. That's why we see 40% of inmates in federal prisons being black, whereas black people only make up 13% of the general population. His argument is that is because of racist police forces, disparate policing.
So, but you really could look at this in a much, much different way, looking at the same set of data and say 90%+ of the inmates within prison are fatherless, for example, and say it, rather than focusing on race, let's do something about trying to get fathers to fulfill their role and their responsibility to their own children. Let's enact policies that encourage families to stay together in order to prevent criminality and other societal ills. So the school that is told you stop suspending blacks in order to make sure that your proportions are correct and that type of thing, I would think pretty quickly you'd be able to see more problems. You'd see if there's a student who, no matter what color he is creating problems, but for outside reasons, they are not allowed to enact the disciplinary measures that would bring that problem to heel, you're going to have more of that problem. That's basic logic.
And we're seeing that exact same thing happen. The schools in St. Paul are in chaos. The ones that have adopted these recommendations put forth by the Justice Department. There was a story not long ago we actually even reported on at thetrumpet.com, just chronicling these incidents where students were just out of control, headlocking teachers, hip-tossing them to the ground, causing fights in the schools, and students not being able to be expelled or suspended to meet the quotas.
Well, it'll be interesting to see where this leads, because if the government... First of all, the one thing that we didn't even really get into is just the creepy nature of this idea that they're accumulating all of this data on us, and the fact that they want to use this for their own purposes. I don't think there's too many Americans that are going to be too excited about having all of this data collected on them. And it seems to me like there would be a lot of Americans who would be very opposed to the idea of the government trying to control outcomes based on race. There's something just very un-American about the whole idea that we're judging people on the purely on the color of their skin rather than the content of their character. But it will be interesting to see the kind of backlash that this might even create among Americans who would resent the implication that somehow everything that they're doing is suspect.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I would have expected to see much more vocal opposition to this when the NSA scandal broke. And there's people from the right and the left that were just right on top of this. This was something that was very un-American. But in this case, besides a few on the right, it's been very, very muted. And it's surprising because, like you said, this is the intent of this program is to take social engineering to the next level. And we're seeing that where they're even telling cities and suburbs that, look, you're not integrated enough. If you don't start building low-cost housing in these rich neighborhoods for poor people, you're losing your federal grant money. And many cities and communities have become very dependent on the federal government. And they're having to make these calculations in their minds now. We know that we need this federal money. Should we be doing this? And at the same time, they know these policies have failed in the past. There have been times where the government has tried to engineer communities, move minorities into white neighborhoods to balance them out. And they find out that just naturally by themselves, these communities resegregate themselves. It's natural. People like to be around people who are like them, that they identify with. And when they've interviewed these people after that, they've moved into different communities. That's what they tell these social engineers. They say things like, well, I just wanted to go back and be with my friends and family in these other neighborhoods. And so we see it where we get, you know, communities like up in Dearborn in Michigan, that's mostly Muslim communities. We have the little Chinatowns in various parts of America. We have little Somalia up in Minnesota. It's natural for people to do that, to segregate with people of like mind. And all the social engineering in the world doesn't change human nature.
but it could create some problems.
It does create some problems. It does.
They're trying to create some kind of a racial utopia through this engineering that you're describing, but you could see all kinds of backlash resulting from that, and people who would be resentful of being forced into the boxes that the government would try to put them in. It's not difficult to see, I would think, real problems coming from these efforts to try to correct America's racial ills in these kinds of forced ways. It'll be interesting. President Obama isn't in office all that much longer, assuming everything goes the way that it looks like it will. It could be a really bumpy ride ahead for us over the next several months.
Well, as the New York Post wrote pretty recently on this issue, that the infrastructure that's put in place now, that President Obama has put in place, is going to last far beyond his presidency. This is going to be used for lawsuits going forward like crazy. This is going to be used to justify racial policies that America probably could not imagine would happen in the land of the free.
The title of the article, President Obama's Vast New Anti-Racism Database by Robert Morley. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks, Robert, for coming in.
You're welcome.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The Iranian nuclear deal has raised the specter of Iran becoming a nuclear state. Now, nuclear war is something that's very unreal to most people. It's been a long time since anyone suffered the effects of a nuclear bomb being detonated. I remember as a kid, I grew up toward the end of the Cold War. Nuclear war with Russia was on a lot of people's minds. In 1983, the movie The Day After caused quite a stir. In school, we were talking about the possibility of a bomb going off. We even had bomb drills. Today, though, the prospect of a bomb doesn't seem very real to many people. Trumpet writer Brad McDonald has written an article discussing the reality of nuclear war by looking at those who experienced its horrors firsthand, the people who went through the attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II. I have Mr. McDonald here with me via Skype from our office in the UK. How are you doing, Brad?
Doing well, thank you.
So this book, can you tell us about this book that gives a firsthand account from the people who experienced this?
Right. The title of the book is Hiroshima, and some of the older people in the audience may have heard of it. They probably have heard of it. It was written by John Hershey. It was a bestseller. Millions of copies have been distributed around the world in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And it was required reading for a lot of children in the 60s, 70s, 80s. It sounds like, it was required reading for you too, even in 1981, 1982.
I never read the book. I remember it being a big deal. This was in the middle of the Cold War, and it was mutually assured destruction between the United States and Russia. And that television movie, it was a huge sensation in the United States, and it was the topic of a lot of discussion even in elementary schools at that time.
Well, the story is, in May 1946, the New Yorker magazine sent John Hershey. I think he'd written one book by then. He was a regular journalist for the New Yorker. They sent John to Japan, and they wanted him to interview survivors of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. They wanted him to visit those two cities, and they wanted him to get a firsthand look at the destructiveness of a nuclear bomb. This was the first time in history that something like this had occurred. So a lot of people had maybe seen a few images. There had been some newspaper articles, but the New Yorker sent John over there with the goal of making it real for the audience. So he went over there. He was over there for a month or two. He conducted hundreds of interviews with survivors, and the book Hiroshima tells the story of six individuals who were in Hiroshima when Little Boy was dropped. I think it was August 6th, 1945. And the Little Boy was the name of the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. So John goes through and he tells the story of these six individuals. One of them was an office clerk, one was a doctor, one was a priest, and he just relays the hours and even the days after little boy was dropped on Hiroshima.
So you get an idea of the level of destruction, say, close to the detonation site.
Right.
And then obviously the effects are different as it goes out. The people who survived this obviously were some distance away enough that they were able to survive the initial blast. But then the effects that they personally experienced were quite severe from the after effects.
Right. So I think 65,000 people were killed instantly in the zone right around the impact zone. 100,000 were injured. Hiroshima was a city of 250,000, and pretty much the entire city was destroyed. The people who survived, they were all at least 1,000 to 1,500 to 2,000 meters from the impact point. But they all felt the effects, obviously. They were thrown across the room. They were buried in rubble. They experienced terrible, terrible burns. They witnessed friends and family be killed. And, they experienced it very intimately. And like I said, they were 1,000 or 1,500 meters away from where it actually landed.
So what were the effects, say, over in the initial hours after the blast?
Well, at first, there was just shock and silence. No one had a clue what had just happened. Each of these individuals that Hershey interviewed recalled seeing a blinding light and then just a few seconds later, a massive explosion. They were all thrown against a wall or thrown against a rock. They were all dislodged. And then for a few minutes after, there was just shock and disbelief. Hershey recounts how one or two of them kind of just walked around, and a lot of people were expecting that a bomb had been dropped locally. They expected to see a few houses blown up on their street, but these people walked to the top of the hill and they just looked around, and as far as the eye could see, houses were just completely flattened. There was smoke. There was this miasma, as Hershey put it, which is just miasma. I think it means there was a putrid stench. Kind of like a chemical smell in the air. And then over the next few minutes and over the next hour or two or three, what happened is those who were closest to the detonation or to the impact where the bomb impacted and survived, those people started making their way out. Obviously, they were running away from where the explosion occurred. And these six survivors helped those people. And they talk about just some horrible images of, people with their eye sockets or their eyes melted and the fluid running down their cheeks. People with skin that had peeled from their body. One of the individuals talked about how he was trying to lift or he was trying to pull someone into a boat that he was on, and the skin on their arm just kind of peeled off in his hands. There really is just. It's scenes that are hard for us to imagine, if any of us can imagine them, usually it's with the help of a movie or special effects in some Hollywood film. But this was real. This really happened, and it happened to thousands and thousands of people.
It does seem like the people, the New Yorker sending this journalist over there, recording these and ensuring that these images were preserved and spread, and the people who wanted to introduce this into school curricula, that type of thing, they were trying to make something that is difficult for the mind to grasp more real to us, to understand the effects, to understand just how devastating something like this can be. You can look at in a history book and you can see statistics. And it seems to me like the same kind of failure to grasp reality kind of surrounds this whole negotiation and deal that has been going on with Iran. The specter of nuclear war just is not real to us, and it is something that's worth setting your imagination on.
Right. The term nuclear war or the thought of a nuclear bomb exploding, it's addressed in a movie. We have a James Bond detonating a nuclear weapon and saving the day, or it's just a political talking point. It's a political issue. It's more of an intellectual exercise. I can't think of too many people, at least recently, who have really sat down and just talked about, okay, what does a nuclear explosion look like? What does it feel like? What does it smell like? I can't think of, you know, too many news organizations approaching the subject of nuclear warfare from that perspective.
No, it's not something we want to think about.
Right. It's unpleasant to think about. And, you know, human nature doesn't like to think about unpleasant things or things that make it feel uncomfortable or that might be emotionally disturbing. So we don't do it. But that doesn't mean it's not a reality.
It seems to me like what you're describing, that aspect of human nature that wants to put these kinds of thoughts out of mind, that's kind of underpinning a lot of what's happening politically right now with respect to Iran. It's almost like the unwillingness to accept the idea that someone would actually use a weapon like this.
Right. And I think it gets back to the intellectual vanity of these guys sitting at the negotiating table with Iran. They think that they're smart enough to prevent this from ever happening. And it's not just the politicians, it's the media, and I think it's the mainstream public in general. As a society, we think that we're so advanced morally and we're so advanced in our basic human emotions that, well, you know, we're so advanced, we're so sophisticated, we're so enlightened in the 21st century that no one would think about dropping a nuclear weapon. They trust in their ability to reason with someone who wants to potentially drop a nuclear weapon, or they think that they can be talked out of it. They just overestimate their ability to solve the problem or they think they can solve it with conversation, with reason, with negotiation, with compromise. And I think it just reveals a massive false sense of security. And at its core, a basic trust in the self.
Yeah, just the basic goodness of human beings. And they're backed up by a lot of people who are so caught up in distractions and other pursuits that they have no reason to think about those things until the day comes when something like this actually does blow up in our faces.
Right. Right. Yeah, you look at the 21st century Western world and it doesn't look like we're living in the Middle Ages. We're far less barbaric, you know, we're far less simple-minded, we're far less intolerant. This is what people are thinking. We're far less intolerant. Everything is pretty and shiny, and our leaders have PhDs and they've been to university where they learn how to negotiate and form compromises. We're beyond detonating nuclear weapons. That's so 20th century.
The interesting thing is just to contrast everything that you're describing with, say, the images that are coming out of the Middle East that were being provided by the Islamic State, and just some of the realities of terrorist attacks that are going on throughout that region. And you see some of the barbarity that's taking place even just south of the United States border within Mexico.
Right.
You realize, you know, we're not so different from some of those more darker periods in human history. The difference is that the destructive potential of the weapons that are available is much, much greater.
Absolutely. The little boy was a 15 kiloton nuclear bomb. That's 0.015 megatons. It killed 60,000 people. It injured 100,000 people. It wiped out an entire city. Today, you know, we have about 20,000 nuclear bombs around the planet. Most of these bombs are significantly larger in size than Little Boy. Little Boy, as I mentioned, was 15 kiloton. Today's nuclear bombs are 15,000 to 20,000 kilotons. Some of them are 50,000 kilotons, which is more than 3,000 times more powerful than that bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima.
Unbelievable.
And as you alluded to, you know, not only do we have these weapons, 20,000 of them on the planet, but we have, let's say, we see the mental or the psychological requirements to start a nuclear war present on this earth. You know, the decision to start a nuclear war, it happens in someone's mind, and they're influenced by one, you know, they're influenced by fear, or maybe they're influenced by uncertainty, or maybe they're influenced by a desperate hatred for whomever they drop the bomb on. Maybe they're a religious fanatic and they believe it's their duty to start, you know, World War III. We see the psychological requirements for nuclear war.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, it's there. The motivation for great conflict or the motivation for nuclear war, it's there.
Gerald Fleury talks about this in this Key of David program that will be airing this Friday. The fact that an Iranian nuke, a nuclear weapon in the hands of an Iranian leader, is much different than it is in the hands of any other nation that's ever possessed these weapons because of that religious zealotry aspect of it. There's an extremely unpredictable, like the whole concept of mutually assured destruction is founded on the fundamental desire to survive and to protect your people and those elements of civilization that have prevailed that would prevent someone from doing that. It doesn't work in this that model doesn't work if you have someone at the helm who is actually seeking apocalypse.
Right, exactly. And then we can't forget that this world is influenced and led, you know, by a spiritual influence, by Satan the devil. And he loves conflict. He loves war. He has no hesitation inflicting suffering on mankind.
When you put the descriptions, say, from this journalist who recorded what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki immediately after World War II and hold it up against biblical prophecies of exactly what's going to happen in this world in the days just leading up to the second coming of Jesus Christ, you see a whole lot of overlap. You see a lot of alignment there.
Right. There are a number of prophecies. Isaiah has two or three prophecies. There's prophecies of nuclear war in Matthew 24. The book of Revelation has imagery which implies nuclear destruction. I haven't got it in front of me, but there's a prophecy in Isaiah that talks about in the end time, when the conflict comes in the end time, you know, that weapons will be used, warfare will be used, that will result in people's eyeballs melting in their sockets, just like Hershey recalls in his book. A prophecy in Joel talks about blinding flashes of light across the earth. Again, Hershey recalls that in his book. That's what these people saw immediately or as soon as the bomb was dropped. And there are just a number of prophecies that very clearly the way the prophecy is described and the devastation that is experienced, it can only come about as a result of nuclear explosions.
Right. You don't look at conventional weapons creating these kinds of conditions.
Exactly.
Yeah, amazing. It's really, really important subject to try to wrap our minds around, and we know that it's going to become reality very soon, and you can see conditions in the world today leading us right down the primrose path to that future, a repetition of history, only many times worse. Thank you, Mr. McDonald. The article is called Fire from the Sky by Brad McDonald. It's due to be in the coming edition of the Trumpet, the September issue of the print edition of the Trumpet News Magazine, and you can read it online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for your time, Brad.
You're welcome.
Is Trumpet Hour.
Last week, New Horizons, the probe, went past Pluto at 30,000 miles an hour, 3 billion miles away from Earth. It was just a remarkable scientific achievement. Now, Pluto, we knew basically nothing about this planet, and now we have just a mountain of scientific data that this probe collected from this flyby that they're going to be processing over the next 16 months. It's going to take that long just to transmit all of this data back to home to learn about just about this world that lives on the outside extremities of our solar system. We're so curious about the universe. We want to know what's out there, and we know so little about it. We've been sending out spacecraft for about 50 years just to explore our solar system, those bodies that are closest to us. And one by one, we've gotten some spectacular close-ups of these neighboring planets. And every time we've sent a probe, we've learned things that we didn't even know that we couldn't have predicted. And Pluto was the most unknown of them all. And that's what motivated scientists to send this probe out. Back in 2006, January 19th, this probe was perched on top of a rocket and shot out into space at 36,000 miles an hour. Now, it's a small little probe. It's the size of a grand piano. It's very fast. It's able to cruise 1 million miles a day. It's extremely efficient. It only had 170 pounds of fuel on it to make a 3 billion-mile journey. But it's loaded with highly sophisticated reconnaissance instruments in order to gather as much data as it possibly can, knowing that its whole purpose was this little flyby that took place over the course of just a few days last week. Now, imagine the calculations required to make a probe that exits Earth's atmosphere to reach exactly the right destination at exactly the right time, 3 billion miles away. This is like the beauty of a perfectly timed 80-yard touchdown pass on a cosmic scale. The quarterback has to throw not to where the receiver is, but where he's going to be when the football finishes its flight path. And the scientists had to figure out exactly how to map the route and the speed of this probe's path, how physical forces would operate on it over the course of nearly a decade, and then calculate how it would align perfectly with the path of this little dwarf planet. They factored in a really nifty slingshot using the planet Jupiter. They charted its path right past Jupiter, and while it was going past, they harvested 4 months' worth of observations about Jupiter, the largest planet in our solar system, and they used Jupiter's gravitational pull to actually pick up 9,000 miles an hour worth of speed on this aircraft. It had slowed down a little bit as it was getting farther away from Earth, and that trick shaved 3 years off the trip to Pluto for this little probe. Now, after it passed Jupiter, it went into hibernation for about 10 months out of every year. They shut down as many systems as they possibly could for the remainder of its trip out to this planet in order to conserve as much energy as possible. So here's this lonely little robot scooting farther and farther away from home. And meanwhile, the scientists are able to monitor all its systems. They're able to update its software. They resolved computer glitches. They made course corrections. Just a tremendous amount of control that they had over this thing, even as it was getting farther and farther from headquarters. Well, last week, after 3,463 days, they completed the touchdown pass. And there was this rendezvous between this dwarf planet. It had moved 874 million miles along its orbital path, and this probe that had traveled 3 billion miles to visit it. So it was out there traveling for nearly 500 weeks, and it passed by Pluto 72 seconds ahead of schedule, and it was 43 miles off its projected course. That is just an amazing, amazing level of precision. Flying within 7,750 miles of Pluto's surface, it was flying past at 10 miles a second, recording everything it could, all of its recording devices operating at full strength. Just a tremendous achievement. And I think it tells you, too, something about just the precision of our universe that operates according to very predictable laws of physics that they were able to use and to make sure that everything operated exactly according to plan. This successful mission, this marks the end of an age of planetary exploration for human beings. We're not going to see another new planet up close for the first time, not in this age. Pluto was the last of known worlds to explore, and there's no space agency that's planning a similar mission. Now, New Horizons, it's still going to be moving out there, I think, within 3 or 4 years and another billion miles. It's going to reach more distant significant objects within the Kuiper Belt. This is a huge ring of icy debris that encompasses our solar system. And then after that, it's going to move out into interstellar space. And there's really nothing out there. Certainly, it's not expected to hit anything that it'll be able to report home about. But if you think about the magnitude of this trip and you put it in the context of the size of the universe, if anything, this really reinforces just how impossible it would be for us to make our way out to anything that was more distant than Pluto. If you took our entire solar system, if you took the orbit of Pluto and you shrunk that down to a beach ball, you were holding that beach ball in your lap, on that scale, the nearest star to us, Proxima Centauri, would be 1 mile away, a mile away from you with nothing in between. And think about this. We knew almost nothing about Pluto, and this is still just right in our cosmic backyard. We knew almost nothing about it until we were able to get within just a few thousand miles of it. What lies beyond? What do we know about everything that's beyond our solar system? We really need to recognize just how ignorant we really are about what's going on there. But this all brings to mind a truth that we can read about in the Bible. There's an amazingly inspiring verse in Isaiah 45 and verse 18. It says, "For thus says the Eternal that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it. He has established it. He created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited." He formed it to be inhabited. Now, there are actually several other verses in the Bible that show what the purpose of the universe is, and it really does say that the purpose of the universe is to be inhabited. God didn't create it just to make a lot of pretty lights. He actually created it to be inhabited. You can also read Isaiah 51 and verse 16, where God says, "And I have put my words in your mouth, and I have covered you in the shadow of my hand, that I may plant the heavens and lay the foundations of the earth." It says that God intends to plant the heavens. Now, when you plant something, you're laying down seeds that you expect to grow into a crop. That's what that Hebrew word is talking about. It's the same word that's used in Genesis 2 and verse 8 to say that God planted a garden in Eden. In Genesis 9, it says Noah planted a vineyard. Abraham planted a tree. In Genesis 21, Isaiah 51 says God is going to plant the heavens, the abode of the stars or the universe. He's going to seed it with life, expecting that it's going to grow into a greater and a more impressive harvest in time. That is the amazing truth that is revealed in the Bible. And if you'd like to know more about this, we really want to encourage you to get this booklet, Our Awesome Universe Potential. It's a beautiful booklet. It's got a ton of pictures from the Hubble telescope of some of the glories of the universe, and it explains what the purpose of the universe is. You can find it on thetrumpet.com. Go to the library tab under literature and look for Our Awesome Universe Potential, and it'll explain this wonderful, astounding, eye-opening truth to you.
It's time for today's last word.
Scientists in recent years have accumulated evidence showing that specific features in creation, Earth in particular, must be extremely fine-tuned in order to support life. One well-known example is the Earth's distance from the sun. It is just right to keep temperatures here hospitable, somewhere between 30 below zero and 120 degrees Fahrenheit. If we were farther away, we would freeze. If we were closer to the sun, we would roast. In their book, The Cosmos, Astronomy in the New Millennium, astronomers Jay Pasikoff and Alex Filipenko wrote this: "The values of the physical constants, not to mention the laws of physics, seem to be spectacularly fine-tuned for life as we know it. Indeed, almost tailor-made for humans. In many cases, if things were altered just a tiny amount, the results would be disastrous for life." Did you realize that the vast majority of the universe in its present form is uninhabitable? It is too hot, too cold, too dense, too dark, too bright. It has too much radiation or too few of the heavy elements required for life. Gravitational forces are too intense. Environments are too unstable. Scientists have come to recognize just how remarkable our cosmic location is. We're far enough from the center of the Milky Way so we're not bombarded by radiation. We're nowhere near dangerous star clusters or quasars or nebulae. We're right next to this very stable star called the Sun. A whole host of factors make our planet's position just perfect. And Earth's advantages go beyond just its location. Earth is 7,913.1 miles in diameter. And even though it just floats in space, it weighs about 6,000 million, million, million tons. And scientists have learned several reasons why this is the ideal size and mass. For example, if it were less dense, it wouldn't have enough gravity to retain an atmosphere like the planet Mercury. If it were larger and denser, we couldn't live in its thick atmosphere. It would be like Jupiter's. Humans need almost 30 elements to live: hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, calcium, iron, sodium, and so on. Earth has just the right mix of all of them, with a rich abundance of rare but vital heavy elements in its core and sprinkled through its crust and mantle. Earth's distances from both the Sun and the Moon are also perfect to ensure it has a stable, predictable orbit with 24-hour days. So the planet doesn't get too hot or too cold. The entire surface of Earth is properly warmed and cooled every day. Thanks to our single large moon, Earth is tilted at a nice, gentle 23.5-degree angle. Planets that have no moons or a relatively small moon have a rotation axis that tilts very chaotically. Without our moon, Earth would experience catastrophic climate changes. But as it is, that tilt gives us predictable, pleasant seasonal changes that provide variety and facilitate annual food production all over the planet. These are extraordinary features. Recognizing this, scientists have concocted elaborate explanations of how they all came about through indiscriminate natural forces over billions of years. But the book of Job provides a more plausible explanation. Job was a great builder, and he became somewhat self-impressed. God helped correct his perspective. In Job 38, God provided an awesome picture of a moment in the universe's history. When he built the earth, God asks Job, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if you have understanding." Our planet didn't come to inhabit its perfect place in the cosmos haphazardly. God says he actively set the earth in this precise location. "Who determined earth's measurements?" God asked Job. "Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it?" Our planet's size and extraordinary elemental composition are not the product of arbitrary forces. They were measured and precisely surveyed, perfectly prepared to suit God's purposes. God continued, "Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof?" The physical forces that anchor our planet and stabilize it, so crucial to its being able to host life, aren't luck. Our Creator established them. In Isaiah 45 and verse 18, God says he formed the earth to be inhabited. After hearing God's speech, Job was humbled. His appreciation for God's creative genius and power had multiplied, and his perspective on himself had shrunk to far more realistic proportions. Today's scientific revelations are telling us the same basic truths, confirming the biblical record. Surely we should be similarly awed and inspired. As King David wrote in Psalm 19, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament," or the expanse of heaven, shows his handiwork. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to read the stories that we talked about today, and you can get a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. Send us your thoughts or your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter @@thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook or Google+ by searching for Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank my guests today, Robert Morley and Brad McDonald. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from William Butler Yeats. Education is not the filling of a pail, but the lighting of a fire. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG. And on the web at kpcg.fm.